Welcome to the ABA program, Public Access to Court Records, Protecting Personal Sensitive Information, co-sponsored by the Section of Individual Rights and Responsibilities, the Section of Environment, Energy and Resources, the Princeton University Center for Information Technology Policy, and the ABA Center for Continuing Legal Education. Moderating the program today is Nicole M. Wallfauer with International Paper, Memphis, Tennessee.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Nicole Wallfauer, and I'm Chief Counsel, HR and Global Policy Compliance at International Paper. I've been with IP for about 10 years. I'd like to introduce our presenters for this program. We are very fortunate today to have these privacy advocates and experts on public access to government records. First, I'd like to introduce Grayson Barber. Grayson is the lead author of the materials that were provided with this conference, and she is a privacy advocate with a law office in Princeton, New Jersey. She serves on the advisory board of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, and she works as a volunteer for the American Civil Liberties Union. Grayson advises the Intellectual Freedom Subcommittee of the New Jersey Library Association and chairs the Individual Rights Section of the New Jersey State Bar Association. I'd also like to introduce to you Stephen Schultz. He is the Associate Director for the Center of Information Technology Policy at Princeton University. His work at CITP includes internet privacy, security, government transparency, telecommunications policy, and more. He's part of the team that built RECAP, which is a free tool for sharing court records. Lily Coney is also joining us. Lily is the Associate Director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC. EPIC is a public interest research center in Washington, D.C. EPIC was established in 1994 to focus public attention on emergency civil liberties issues and to protect privacy, the First Amendment, and constitutional values. Ms. Coney identifies emerging privacy issues, manages EPIC's Privacy Coalition, and outreach to civil society organizations in the U.S. and around the world. And finally, I'd like to introduce Helen Nissenbaum. Helen is Professor of Media, Culture, and Communication and Computer Science and Senior Fellow of the Information Law Institute at New York University. She is also the author of Privacy in Context, which is published by Stanford Law Books, and she has written extensively on the issue of privacy in public. Grayson, could you begin by discussing some of the types of information, personal information, that can be found in court records that are available to the public?
Yes, thank you so much, Nicole. Let me talk for a couple of minutes about the kinds of confidential personal information that are found in court records. And then, if I may, I'd like to talk for a moment about the trajectory of this webinar so that the audience will have a sense of how the issues will unfold in our presentation. Let me start by talking about personal information in court records. You know that for many, many years, I mean, I think as long as there has been a court system in the United States, there's been an understanding that court proceedings should occur in public. And the rule has always been that court records are, they're public records. They're available to the public. And one of the questions I hope we will have a chance to address in this webinar is why it's so important to have court records available to the public. Now, one phenomenon of the digital age is that the records that used to be on paper, you know, the basements of courthouses are full of dusty banker's boxes with paper records. And the rule has always been that, you know, you could go into the courthouse and you could ask the clerks to dig up one of these banker's boxes so that you could get somebody's litigation file or even a file containing a real estate transaction, and that information would just be available to you because you're a member of the public and these are public records. But now that the records are being digitized, they're in electronic form, they're being sold to the public, and some of the information there is pretty confidential. Let me run down a laundry list. The first and probably the most important item of information is Social Security numbers. You know, in the bad old days, people didn't realize that Social Security numbers were a very important link to get a lot of information about you, and people would just disclose their Social Security numbers right and left. They'd put, you know, they'd give their Social Security number to the video store or, you know, if anybody asked for it. And for many years, the practice was to add your Social Security number to your name if you were giving a piece of paper in a court filing, just to make sure that the right name corresponded to the right person. So court records are full of Social Security numbers, even when the Social Security numbers aren't necessarily required for the court record. Income and business tax returns are routinely stapled to court records. Sometimes they're just stapled to complaints because the complainant would think that, well, here's, you know, the information about me that's on the tax return. Especially in divorce cases or family cases, typically the filings will include tax returns. So even though, you know, you can't get tax returns from the IRS, you can get them from court records and get a lot of financial information about people. In family law cases, especially, there's sensitive information provided by the parties, including information about children. In slip and fall cases, car accidents, and so on, there's a lot of medical records. There's certainly home addresses of not just the litigants, but also information about witnesses, about jurors, about anybody who interacts with the court system. Sometimes there are photographs that have pictures of violence or death or children. There's sexual assault cases, domestic violence cases. For witnesses in criminal cases, even though the witnesses aren't accused of anything, but they've been hailed into court, you can get their names, addresses, and phone numbers. Informants in criminal cases. Jurors. For years have been giving their names, addresses, and telephone numbers. And there has been an argument that, well, all court records are public records, so we should be able to find out who the jurors are who have been sworn in criminal cases. There's questionnaires, voir dire transcripts, psychological evaluations of parties, information related to the conduct and discipline of judicial officers, allegations of misconduct, and then in some cases there are trade secrets and other intellectual property. So I put this before you because I think sometimes it's easy to forget just how much confidential information is in court records, just stapled to motions or other pleadings. And once this information is in electronic form and disclosed from the courthouse, it can be used for unrelated purposes. So that's my laundry list. Now, to get back to the trajectory of this webinar, I want to echo Nicole's welcome and say how privileged I feel to be given an opportunity to hear these speakers. Steve Schultz from Princeton University will talk about access to court records and why it's so important. There are a number of very serious interests that are served by having court records available to the public. Then Lily Coney will talk about principles of fair information practices. These are not necessarily privacy interests, but they are a set of practices and principles that govern the disclosure of digital information. And they seek to balance the interests of privacy and the interests of public access to information. Professor Helen Nissenbaum is an expert on the problem of privacy in public. A lot of things are labeled public, but they involve confidential personal information, and Professor Nissenbaum has authority on how to approach questions of privacy in public so that you can strike the right balance and protect individuals. Nicole Walthour is officially the moderator of this group, but she's a moderator for a reason. At International Paper, she was responsible for negotiating the Safe Harbor certification for the company's business practices in Europe. Europe has much more protective privacy laws than the United States has, and they are largely modeled on the principles of fair information practices that Lily Coney will be talking about. Although it's not directly related to the issue of public access to court records, I think we will all benefit from hearing Nicole Walthour speak about her negotiation on behalf of International Paper. And then finally, the webinar will come back around to me, and I'm hoping to have a chance to revisit the fundamental problem of protecting privacy and ensuring that court records are available to the public. So I think the speaker who is up now is Steve Schultz from Princeton University. Steve, will you talk about the importance of public access to court records and your work to make the court records freely available to anybody who wants to read them?
Sure, Grayson, I'd be happy to. And I think I'll start by going perhaps even a step back further in history to talk about where these principles come from. And I hope the other panelists can comment on it as well. As far back as English common law, we have examples of access to the courts and access to the proceedings of the courts. In the days of the Star Chamber, which ultimately became somewhat synonymous with abusive private non-public proceedings, the court records were really the spoken records observed by people at the time. There wasn't really a written record of proceedings. And the Star Chamber sort of stands as an example of abuse at the hands of the king, essentially turning the courts into a venue for abusing the people that he didn't agree with and getting back at his political enemies. And the result was that we have a strong legacy going all the way back to English common law of public access to the courts and to court proceedings. As we translated those concepts stateside and as we started building our courthouses, we included a prominent public gallery in those courthouses and a presumption that the public could come in and observe the proceedings. And this was seen as and is seen as important for a variety of reasons. Of course, it's important fundamentally to democracy because rule by secret law is not too different from rule by no law at all or arbitrary rule by the government. It's important for fairness because the rule of law really only works when everyone knows what the law is. And if we truly believe that ignorance of the law is no excuse, then we need to make sure that the law is knowable. It's also important for consistency. People have to know what the decisions were in the past in order for us to have some notion of precedent. And that's important not only to the general public, but to the judiciary as a whole and to practitioners. And also for equality, because unequal access to the law creates inequality within society. So if there are barriers to knowing the law or to gaining access to justice, of course, based on different factors, including the ability to, for example, pay for it, then we generate inequalities within society where law isn't serving the public and isn't treating the public equally across the board. Our precedent in the U.S. around access to court records has followed a similar line. A lot of this precedent revolves around cases like Richmond Newspapers versus Virginia, establishing a strong precedent for access to non-sealed court records. And there are a couple of different lines of precedent, sort of reinforcing these English common law notions of public access to the courts. And it's important to distinguish in Grayson, in your list of confidential information in court records, there is a set of information which is included in sealed records and intentionally sealed because there's not seen to be a compelling public interest in, for example, knowing my Social Security number, and other records which are by default in unsealed records. And then there are then there's content which should have been sealed, but counsel didn't follow the rules or didn't listen closely enough to their clients and included personal information that probably should have been sealed. So that's an important distinction, and I'll mention that at the end of my remarks as well, and hopefully that can also feed into the discussion of the other folks on the panel. Today I'm going to talk a little bit about PACER, which probably most folks on the call are familiar with. PACER is, of course, the U.S. federal courts system for electronic access to court records. It stands for Public Access to Court Electronic Records. It's been around for quite some time and has evolved over time. When it was first developed as a dial-up system in the late 80s, it was tremendously ahead of its time. And when it was transitioned to be a web service in the 90s, it was likewise tremendously ahead of its time. However, it's an interesting artifact when you look at it in the context of public access to these records, because the way that PACER is structured, as most folks who have used it will be aware of, is around a per-page access fee model. The charges, of course, are for the court records themselves, but also for searches and other types of reports. And whereas if you know what you're looking for, 8 cents a page is not tremendously expensive, it can be prohibitively expensive for doing quite a few different kinds of things. And trying to understand, for example, the corpus as a whole, or to do analysis on things like, say, decisions by particular judges over time to try to understand things like judicial bias or trends or things like that. Some of the types of things that were seen as critical in the earliest decisions around public access to the courts, if we try to do those in a systematic electronic way using the current system, it's fairly difficult. And even for your average end user who's just looking for a few documents, the PACER interface can be troublesome because the search interface is very limited. There's no kind of full-text search. The documents are not structured in a tremendously meaningful way, and the user interface can be challenging. So while it's true that often attorneys who have to do particular tasks for particular clients can do so using PACER, and in fact, I should note that much of what they do is probably on the CMECF side of things, the electronic filing system, which is the sort of partner to PACER. It's the for the parties, it's really the interface for filing documents and managing case materials. For the general public trying to understand what's going on in the system, it can be very challenging and daunting, especially because before you access any records whatsoever, you have to provide a credit card, and the documents within the system are not indexed by search engines, which increasingly are the public's interface to the internet at large. So there have been a variety of efforts around trying to understand how we might make the documents in PACER more accessible. There is a larger effort afoot by academics around the country called law.gov, which is an effort to define an approach for all jurisdictions in order to make court records more accessible, electronic court records more accessible. We have done work within one particular jurisdiction, specifically the jurisdiction or jurisdictions covered by PACER, specifically for the district and bankruptcy courts. And our work here at the Center for Information Technology Policy includes writing about it and talking about it, but it also includes a particular project that we have called RECAP. RECAP is PACER backwards, and our catchphrase is turning PACER around. RECAP is a tool that anyone can install on their copy of the Firefox web browser. And it essentially lets PACER users effortlessly share public court documents that they purchase with other RECAP users and with the public as a whole. Essentially, any time that you are browsing PACER and you have RECAP enabled, when you download a public record, it will automatically upload it to a free public archive. It's actually hosted on a site called the Internet Archive, which is well known for doing this kind of work and is providing this service for free. It uploads it to the Internet Archive. It extracts some structured information about that document, and then it lets other people find it either through the Internet Archive, or if you're a RECAP user and you're viewing a PACER docket, and another RECAP user has already downloaded that document and made a document available for free, there's a little notification on your screen that says, you don't have to pay for this. You can actually download it for free from the Internet Archive. We also make the archive as a whole available to the public and to anyone wanting to develop applications around it. And we provide the case information that we've sort of pulled out of the more messy format coming from PACER. We provide that data in a more structured format so that anyone wanting to build a site on top of it can do so, or if it's an academic that wants to download the whole corpus, they can do so. And we actually have an example of this happening. There was a group of undergrads here at Princeton that was interested in this data set and interested in making it more useful, and they spent a semester building a web interface that provides search, much better search functionality, allows search engines like Google and the like to index the site directly, so people will start finding these cases through Google, and also allows you to do a variety of other things, including linking to particular case pages, adding notes about related cases, receiving email updates when a RECAP user uploads a new document and the like. And we saw this as an important implementation of a principle laid out by some folks here at the Center for Information Technology Policy in an article entitled Government Data and the Invisible Hand, which was published in, I think it was 2009, in the Yale Journal of Law and Technology. The essential argument made there is that government data sets should first and foremost be made available in their raw form so that, this is electronic data sets, so that innovators out there in the rest of the world can find useful ways to make it more accessible and more useful to as many people as possible, rather than the government trying to essentially intermediate through its own web and other interfaces. And this was a great example of this happening, because the argument of that paper is that there are people out there who are interested in doing this separately from the government, and that if the data is presented in a useful format, they'll be motivated to do so. So that's the RECAP project. And a lot of the RECAP project has to do with building this particular corpus of documents. But it also has to do with bringing attention to the PACER issue as a whole. In 2002, the e-government act of 2002, which has since been updated, made a change actually to the relevant statute, saying that the judicial conference may, only to the extent necessary, charge fees to, quote, reimburse expenses incurred in providing these services, referring to PACER. With the Senate report that accompanied it, they said that they intend to encourage the judicial conference to move to a fee structure in which the information is freely available to the greatest extent possible, because currently the courts are charging more than the marginal costs of disseminating the information. So the principle here, it seems, coming from Congress, is that PACER should cost only as much as it costs to operate PACER, And in looking more closely at the budgeting documents provided by the courts themselves, it appears that the courts are essentially using PACER to cross-subsidize other things within the judiciary. PACER fees bring in about $120 million a year, only a fraction of which appears to go towards the direct operation of PACER. And from the geek perspective, we have a lot of computer science grad students here. Looking at the way that they have structured their technology, we think that the courts could, in fact, save a lot of money by operating their system in a somewhat more centralized fashion. Right now, PACER is operated individually by each court in each jurisdiction, and there's a great deal of decentralization and duplication of costs. Finally, by way of transitioning to the other panelists, I'll mention a little bit about privacy concerns. Of course, as we built up this corpus, I think we're up to at least 2.5 million documents now. We wanted to proceed in a way that would be sensitive to private information that might be included in these documents. Now, it should be said that all of these electronic documents are being provided to the public, and they're coming from unsealed documents, and they're intended to be provided to the public electronically via PACER. But we knew that in the process of making them more accessible to search engines and the like, that we should probably, even if we don't have a legal duty, we probably have a moral obligation to look a little bit more closely at these documents to see what we're making available. So we have done some research using automated computer science techniques to try to find both clear cases where things have been included that shouldn't be included, like social security numbers, but also to do some more sophisticated machine learning techniques to try to identify documents that are likely to contain materials that should be redacted or should have been redacted, and to flag them. I should also note that the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure 5.2 and the corresponding rules for the circuit courts and, in many cases, corresponding very similar rules for the state courts lay out a variety of types of information that should be redacted. And out of our corpus that we scanned, which is about 2 million documents, we found more than a couple thousand documents with sensitive information that should have been redacted. And if we extrapolate that to the PACER corpus as a whole, this is on the order of about 15,000 documents that contain information that probably should have been redacted, but was not, either not at all or it was incorrectly redacted. One of our favorite examples is when counsel tries to redact by taking a PDF and essentially drawing a black box over the text, but in fact leaving the text in the document. The effect of this, of course, is that not only can you extract the rest of the text simply by copy and pasting the text out of it on your desktop, but search engines and the like will see that text, index it, and cache it, and make it searchable. We think that in order to make PACER documents more accessible to the public, we need a two-pronged approach. One is to, in general, figure out ways to remove the paywall and make things more accessible, and that may include encouraging the courts to take some of these cost savings measures. And the other part of the approach is to deal with the privacy problems as we see them, so that putting things on the public internet is not as problematic. And some of these automated computer science approaches with human intervention, we think, can be useful in that regard. I should note, at the federal level, the courts themselves, the clerks, do not take any responsibility for any of this sensitive information, so they're not redacting or flagging documents themselves. They essentially require counsel to do so and assume that the adversarial process will take care of it. What we have seen as a result of our research is that this is often not the case. It's interesting to compare that to the state courts, where some state courts do, in fact, already run their documents through commercial products for detecting potential redactions and take a more active role. I don't know the full history of why the federal courts take the approach that they do. I think some of it has to do with not wanting to incur liability for performing that duty. That's one possible theory. I think some of it just simply has to do with manpower and expertise. So I look forward to talking about those topics with the rest of the panel. If you're curious about the RECAP tool, you can learn more about it and download and install it at recapthelaw.org. That's just all one word, recapthelaw.org. Or if you just search for the words RECAP and PACER, you'll find it fairly quickly. But I look forward to the rest of the conversation, and I will turn it over back to my fellow panelists. Thanks.
This is Grace, and I think the next speaker to talk about the principles of fair information practices and how they apply to the issue of court records and public information is Lily Coney of the Electronic Privacy Information Center.
Thank you, Grayson. This is Lily Coney. I'm the Associate Director at the Electronic Privacy Information Center, and one of the core things that EPIC does is look at the issue of fair information practices to gauge the level of protection offered to personal identifiable information. Now, fair information practices are a set of the essential framework for the collection and use of personal information for any service provision. They have been recognized in our legal system for years, beginning with the magisterial report of the U.S. Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, entitled Records, Computers, and the Right of Citizens, published in 1973. Fair information practices, as outlined in the course materials, begin with the collection limitations. There should be limits on what data is collected and provided through public access by the courts. It's been mentioned that there are the control mechanisms may not be, at this point, the role of the courts, but actually the counsels that are prosecuting or defending within the court regarding the individuals whose data may be collected. Privacy hinges on what is defined as personal information, identifiable information. And in the digital information age, that list is growing. Traditionally, it would include name, address, telephone number, social security number, date of birth, other information that could by itself or in conjunction with other data identify an individual or group of individuals. The list, because of the information, digital information age, is now including email addresses, telephone numbers because of the portability of phone numbers where they make them uniquely identifiable. Regarding individuals, as well as internet protocol addresses or other information that may be associated with individuals, which may become part of court records. Making the determination over what information will be provided to the public and what information should be withheld should be the core values around fair information practices as they relate to personally identifiable information. So the second principle would be data quality, which goes to the principle of accuracy. It's a core tenet of privacy protection that data that's held within a system is, in fact, accurate. Personal data should be relevant for the purpose of the collection. Having information in a system that had no relevance to the matters brought before the court or play any role in the deciding of a matter before a court should not be a part of the court record. The purpose specifications, which is the third principle of fair information practices, is that if data is collected, there should be a reason why that data is collected or made available. If there is no stated purpose for the data being made available or being collected or retained by the court, then that data should not be a part of the court records. Use limitations. Typically, in fair information practices, data collected has a limit to how that data can be used. It's a negotiation between the data subject and the data collector regarding a benefit or a service that requires the exchange of personal information. So as part of that agreement, let's say a person is entering into an agreement to rent furniture or to make a purchase, they provide particular pieces of personal information that is relevant to that particular transaction. It may be the name of the person may be relevant. It may be if it is a cash transaction and requires delivery, then the address of the individual or the address where the delivery should take place would be provided, and so on. And once that data is collected, it's only used for the particular purpose of the data collection. There are rules and regarding this that fall under Fair Information Practices, and most importantly, to protect the privacy interests of the individual in the data that's being collected, but also the process of data collection. Then, of course, security safeguards, so that the data that is collected and retained by the data collector, there is an obligation to secure that information from misuse or abuse. So the obligation to make sure the data is accurate, that it's relevant, that is related to the specific purpose of the collection, and that the rights of the individual whose data is involved, whether it, that right is expressed through the attorneys that are representing the individual, that that's made clear, and that the opportunity to exercise the fair information practices that are attached to the data are made clear and available. The next principle is openness, so that if you as the data subject or the client as the data subject should have access to the records that are being held, and part of that having access to the record is the right to correct incorrect information, so that making the assumption that the court's records would always be accurate is something that a lot of people may assume because the data is coming from courts, especially in under situations where data is being shared, which poses great risk to the individual, which is why the privacy interests are so high. The individual's ability to participate in the way that data is collected, what conditions the data may be used, how the data may be accessed, to exercise the rights that are attached to the data on the part of the data subject, and to be given an opportunity to understand how that data may be used, who might have access to it, especially in a situation where court records are sold and made available to third parties that have nothing to do with the court process of proceedings. It's important to understand how pervasive the data may be within a society, and understanding that the prosecution or the seriousness of court proceedings and all of the types of information that may be contained in those records that were mentioned by Grayson, that there are long-term consequences should data be made available outside of court proceedings that is providing information or detailed or personally identifiable information is made available to third parties. That this presents a number of challenges for the data subject. First, much of our lives is now shaped by the relationship we have with organizations. And in the digital information age, that relationship is not shaped by face-to-face contact. It is literally the records within organizations are the means of how we are how others learn of us and how information about us is shared. And that certain institutions are considered to be more prominent or their data is more important and it can have greater consequences for individuals than other institutions. The courts would rank very highly on the list of institutions whose data would be assumed to be trustworthy and accurate and could be relied upon to make judgments about individuals. While an organization makes and keeps records about individuals to facilitate relationships with them, it also makes and keeps records about individuals for other purposes, such as documenting the record-keeping organization's own actions as well as making it possible for other organizations and government agencies to monitor the actions of individuals. Second, there is an accelerating trend, which we are all very much aware of, toward the accumulation of records of more and more individual personal details, leading to a state where dossiers or profiles become routine. Even some retailers are telling customers at the checkout counter, "Oh, let me update your profile," as if that's something that's been a part of the routine experience of people, when in fact it is a new added complication for privacy that so many data records are now being exchanged, shared, or even collected that literally profiles of all types and descriptions are being developed, which will give courts or even prosecutors or investigators access to information that they otherwise would not have been able to get access to, and the ease of being able to get access to the data, which may in fact find its way into the records of investigators, which in turn might find its way into the records of the courts. From sources that would otherwise never have been tapped because they would not have been a data collectors. And then the digital mainstream of being able to ship data from point A to point B with such ease will compound that particular challenge for personal identifiable information. And more records on individuals are collected and maintained. The ability of the individual to impact the collection and retention of records becomes an even greater challenge. Most record-keeping organizations consult the records of other organizations to verify the accuracy of their own information, which in fact can mean that the court may expunge or change or find that if there's an error in the record, attempt to correct that error in the record. But once the data left the courts, maybe an original sale or sharing of that data, the court may in fact bring back information into its own possession or share information with an institution that had collected earlier data, and that institution makes the decision not to discard the earlier collection which had errors, but retain it, and then the court may not have the ability to, in the present scheme of things, enforce data correction obligations to institutions that collect that data. Once digital data leaves, or once these is even created, it doesn't spoil. It doesn't, you know, lose its sharpness or quality. It doesn't have the qualities of paper records that over time may decay, so that the data can be moved, copied, shipped, stored, reused, and unless the systems themselves are designed to track, log that activity, becomes very difficult for the courts to even say how that data may have actually been used, or the quality or accuracy of records that are maintained that are strictly digital in nature. Finally, the law nor technology gives sufficient tools to individuals to protect the legitimate interest in the records that are created. To maintain the mandate that we ask for privacy protection is that fair information principles be established for all types of record-keeping systems, and that these mandates be established under principles that center around what is personally identifiable information. I'll stop there and allow Q&A for any other questions. Thank you.
Well, Lily Coney, if I may, the principles of fair information practices, I trust they are on the website of the Electronic Privacy Information System?
Yes, they are, and also laws that have been written based on it. The AGW report is there, as well as the basic principles of FIPS, and then the first major law in the U.S. was the Federal Privacy Act, which outlines fair information principles in a way that clearly articulates the objectives.
Okay, just to make sure that everybody gets the website, the acronym for Electronic Privacy Information Center is EPIC. So the website is www.epic.org, EPIC. Professor Helen Nissenbaum, How does your work on contextual integrity apply to the issue of public access to court records?
Well, hello, everybody. Thank you, Grayson, for including me in this. As Grayson Barber mentioned, this is Helen Nissenbaum. I'm a professor at New York University in the Department of Media, Culture, and Communication and a faculty fellow of the Information Law Institute. I should mention that my training, my PhD, is in philosophy, not in law, so I'll try not to go and say things that I'm not qualified to say. But I have been working in the area of ethical and political issues as they relate to information technology and digital media, and privacy has been an area of focus for quite a number of years. And as Nicole mentioned earlier, I just completed a book called Privacy in Context, Technology Policy and the Integrity of Social Life, in which I develop a theory that I call the theory of contextual integrity, which is, if you will, a way to think about privacy. And in the book, I've worked through a number of case studies, and court records as a special case of public records was something that particularly interested me in light of what Grayson Barber had mentioned, this interest in so-called privacy in public. So I thought today I would just talk a little bit more about an ongoing project in which a group of us are trying to see whether we can use contextual integrity to understand questions about public access to court records with a particular interest in the privacy concerns, the privacy issues. But also, in particular, our starting place is the way information technology and the big question that we're confronting at the moment is the placement of court records online. And recognize that court records are fascinating because they sit at the crossing or the confluence of two very strong streams in society. First, as a window into government activity, in this case the judicial branch of government, into activity and practices, and therefore it's crucial, so we believe, for citizens in liberal democratic societies to have access to information about what governments are doing, just as Steve Schulze mentioned. At the same time, courts are a site or are a place that record many of life's most intimate moments, lurid details, critical information, laying bare a great deal of personal information generally. So the first of these impels us to openness and access, but the second of them impels us to restrictiveness and constraint. And so as a result, you find that the creation and dissemination of court records is governed. Now, I would say in all courts, though of course I haven't studied all courts, but I think it's fair to say that, at least in liberal democracies, from the federal down to the very, very local, by complex sets of expectations, policies, and rules that emanate from a variety of sources that are trying to conform with the currents of both of these streams. And the sources of the rules, and again mentioned by my colleagues, come from that they're constitutional sources. There's the common law in which judges make particular decisions about whether a certain piece of information in a court record should be sealed or made available and so forth. There's statutory sources down to fine-grained administrative rules that are made by the bureaucracies within particular courthouses. Now, the questions that arise are basic, like what is a court record? Because cases generate lots and lots of paperwork, and if they go to trial even more, such as transcripts, lists of jurors, and, you know, again, Grayson Barber helped us by listing a lot of the information, personal information is there. And not all of it necessarily becomes part of what we think of as the court record, and then subject to public access. Then also to recognize that there are lots of reasons why information that's part of a case and won't be part of the public record, not only privacy, but for example, state secrets, trade secrets, and then and the various categories that, again, Steve Schulze mentioned. Now, also finally to recognize that there are different ways of imposing restrictions. So you can strike things from the record, you can redact things afterwards, you can prevent them from entering the record, you can seal the record, you can limit who has access to certain parts of the record. So social workers might have access to details of a family record that won't go into the public domain. Now, with these questions in mind, we focused on this issue of online placement. We already have these rules, and we're not experts in analyzing these rules, though we've read a lot of them and we know about a lot of them. And the question is, what do we do about online placement? Now, some of the issues have been settled in the case of PACER and for the federal courts, as discussed by Steve, and of course there are issues with that as well. But around the country, state courts are grappling actively with these questions. And maybe this addresses perhaps a question that Steve asked, which is why federal courts don't take responsibility but state courts do. And that may be also because the records in state courts may just have a lot more detailed personal information in them, and perhaps some of that has already been cleansed by the time they arrive to the federal courts. Anyway, that's just a speculation. In New Jersey, for example, Grayson Barber, who's the convener of the webinar, has been active, and she served on the Special Committee on Public Access to Court Records that was convened by the New Jersey Supreme Court. So these are very active and very important questions about what to do about court records when placing them online. Now, some people, and you may be one of them, may just wonder, you know, what's all the fuss about? Information technology and digital networks are just a new medium, and they offer great efficiencies. So whatever we were doing before with paper or local terminal access can simply be lifted to the new medium and save people the trouble of getting into their cars, finding parking, going through the security mechanisms and so forth. And I would say that law firms too can enjoy these efficiencies once the bumps have been smoothed out, and furthermore when we move to e-filing and the whole process is digitized. But courts, like other institutions that are undergoing these transformations, recognize that there are differences in medium, that the medium, to quote Marshall McLuhan, is the message. I couldn't resist that, apologies. But anyway, that the medium can result in substantive differences. And the rules that we have to generate this delicate balance between the cross currents of privacy and public access can be unsettled when we move from one medium to the other. So if it turned out that some protection came from the practical obscurity of locally based or paper-based court records, and that the placement of records online threatens what some have called hyper-dissemination, then we want to reevaluate the rules and policies that govern public access to court records. And so our project addressed the question of what are the potentially new threats to privacy posed by the transformation of records from paper to digital form, from the dissemination of records locally at the courthouses to networked access in a distributed fashion. And we use the theory of privacy as contextual integrity developed in the book to understand the nature of these transformations and answer the question, which is, in light of the privacy concerns, do courts actually have an obligation to place court records online, or is it okay for them to just go on and continue doing what they've been doing? Now, I want to just take a few minutes to quickly mention the two basic theses of the theory of privacy as contextual integrity. First, the first thesis is that the flow of personal information in society is governed by context-specific social norms. Privacy is not about secrecy, and it's not about the control of information by individuals, but it's about the appropriate flow of personal information. And by appropriate flow, we mean flow according to these context-specific social norms. And when you think about the structure of these norms, or when I considered what the structure of these norms are, the norms take into consideration the actors, who the information is about, who is providing the information, and who is receiving the information. So in the case of court records, the information could be about the plaintiffs, the defendants. They could be about juveniles, the judge, even information about the judges, members of the juries, witnesses, and so forth. So there are a lot of different subjects of the information that goes into the court records. And when I say individuals' subjects, we need to think about them acting in certain roles in a particular social context. And the recipients of the information could be the public, social workers, those present in the courthouses, lawyers for the plaintiffs and the defendants, the press, and so forth. And the types of information, again, we've heard a little bit about it, could be just tons of different types of information: name, address, social security number, what actions were performed, medical records, age, blah, blah, blah. So hard to specify, but lots of different types. And that's another consideration that's important for the norms that govern the flow of information that's relevant to privacy. And finally, something that I call transmission principles, which is under what terms does the information flow from one party to the other. So if you share information with one party, do you have expectations that you're providing information in confidence, under seal? Are you giving it only for the use of the judge? Can the opposing lawyers have that information? Or are you providing the information with no restrictions, and so forth? So these are the principles. Now, when you these rules under which that govern the flow of information in society within different contexts, they actually, I hope they seem quite intuitive, but you'd be surprised that it actually goes against the way privacy rights are formulated in general policy areas, including policies that govern access to court records. And the symptom of this, and here maybe I'm going to challenge some of my fellow panelists, is that the very concept of sensitive information, in my opinion, is problematic, because it suggests that we can divide the universe of personal information into sensitive information on the one hand that's deserving of protection, and non-sensitive information where we might think, well, pretty much anything goes. So in the case of courts and court records, it seems that all we need is to perform this exercise. You know, we all seem to be in agreement social security number is sensitive, then figure out the policies for sensitive information to satisfy privacy rights, and then forget about everything else. But I think this is a huge mistake. According to contextual integrity, all the factors in the norms matter, and information is sensitive not only according to what type it is. So, for example, your medical condition, you may say, is sensitive, but your medical condition is no secret to your doctor, neither should it be. And by the same token, your name might not be considered in many contexts to be sensitive, but if you're at an AA meeting or if you're engaging in provocative political speech, your name could be very sensitive and so forth. Your social security number is sensitive in relation to identity thieves, but it's not sensitive or secret for your employer. So if there's only one thing to take away from what I've said today, it's this, that policies and rules in relation to personal information and court records should consider all the factors, not just the dichotomy of sensitive and non-sensitive information. So that's part one, or thesis one, of the theory. And the second thesis, excuse me, of contextual integrity deals with how we judge the rules, whether the rules that govern access to court records and personal information in them are good rules or not. In particular, when we confront these new technologies that threaten to disrupt the flow of information. And here there are two steps in evaluating norms. One is just to consider the general harms and benefits. And if you look at many of the cases or the discussions involving public interest versus privacy interests, you'll often hear about how the information can harm or embarrass and so forth, and then balance that against the public interest in, of course, open government and open access to court records. But something that's worth mentioning is that the balance that was achieved by the rules that we have, again, is disrupted by online media, because as we all know, there's a huge difference between a photograph that's in an album that you can show to your friends and a photograph that you post online for the world to see, especially as in the case of RECAP, where we hear that the records are then, say, made amenable to full-text search. There's much greater access to court records, and I also want to highlight the point that Lily Coney made, which is the information in the court records is being used by third-party aggregators in a way that's far, far distant from the original ideals that had us declare public access to court records in the first place. And the second step of evaluation asks about how court records serve the purposes of the context in question. And so our project, though it starts off with what might seem like a pretty dry bureaucratic question of what should the rules be governing public access to court records, forces us to confront questions about what is the function of courts in society, especially in democratic societies, settling disputes, punishing wrongdoers, justice and fairness, and so forth. And how do the I note that Steve mentioned the essential function of court records to promote these values, such as accountability, consistency with precedent setting, education, both public education and improving the quality of the performance of judges and lawyers, and so on. So we need to look at the information of the court records and say, do they serve these functions of the courts? And the conclusion that we're coming to in our project, although we haven't completed it, is that there's a lot of personal information sitting in court records that does not contribute to these values, and therefore we should be much more careful about what we include in public in court records to which we allow public access, both online and locally. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Helen, you mentioned that third-party aggregators, and actually this is something that Lily Coney mentioned too, third-party aggregators take information from court records and use them for purposes that are unrelated to the original reasons the information found its way into the courthouse in the first place. This concern about redisclosure of information is governed by laws in Europe that are, I believe, stricter than American law. And Nicole Walthour, I know that you negotiated the safe harbor certification for international paper, and although this it's not directly related to public access to court records, but it touches on the same principles, and I'm wondering if you would be willing to speak for a few minutes before we open for questions and answers about European privacy legislation and your encounters with it.
Well, thank you, Grayson. I have worked with International Paper to achieve Safe Harbor certification, and the company has Safe Harbor certification, and we've recertify every year. But as I was working on that project, what I was struck by was the fact that privacy laws in Europe are much more extensive and than the laws in the United States. The United States seems to take more of a sectorial approach, kind of focusing on things like the financial records or records about children. But in Europe, there is a comprehensive data protection law, and that has been enacted by the European Union, and then each individual country has its own law that basically echoes that data protection law. And I think that the thing that really strikes me as being different from the United States and Europe is that there is a lot of emphasis in the United States on free speech and public access, whereas in Europe, privacy interests are almost like personal property interests. And privacy is a right in a way that it's not a right in our government or in our constitution. And so personal information, which is described, I think, in Europe much more broadly than it is here, it's paramount to keep those private information private. So something as in Europe, your business email address is a personally identifiable piece of information that has to be protected. So I guess the thing that what I was struck by was what Lily was saying about the principles. In many ways, the principles in Safe Harbor and also in the European data protection laws are very similar to those the principles Lily mentioned. And just to go through them quickly, there are seven Safe Harbor principles, and one of them is notice. And as you might imagine, that means that people have to know what kind of data you have about them. The other is choice, so that people have the right to opt out of the use of certain information about themselves. Another is security, that those who are holding personal information have an obligation to keep it secure. Data integrity is another principle, and that means that the personal information has to be basically used for the purpose for which it was intended, and it needs to be maintained in a way that is reliable and accurate. And access is another principle, meaning that employees, at least in the Safe Harbor context, should have access to their information to correct any errors. And then the other principle is onward transfer, which means that a company would have the responsibility to make sure that if they move information from one place to the next, from one part of the company to the next, or to a third-party vendor, that third-party vendor has, or other entity has, the same privacy principles in place and the same kind of security in place as required by Safe Harbor. So I think the way Europe impacts this conversation is the fact that there is a emphasis on personal privacy as a property right or as a right of the individual, which must be addressed before information can be shared or made public. But I think we've gotten to a point now where we ought to begin taking questions from our live audience. Okay. Well, before we take our first question from our audience, I thought I might ask a question of my own, which is, why should the public have any right to see court records of events or such as divorce proceedings or child custody disputes, where the information contained in those records can be some of the most private information that there is about a person, and also involves many times the information of a child who would have no ability to protect his or her own rights?
Well, Nicole, this is Grace, and if I can tackle that first, and then maybe we can turn it over to Steve. I'll talk about the public interest in putting court information, making it available to the public, and then maybe Steve can tackle the question about why there's value in putting it online. In my opinion, the reason for putting court information out there and available to the public doesn't have to do with the newsworthiness or anything else about the litigants. I think it's for the purpose of keeping the courts transparent and accountable. And this is Helen Nissenbaum made this point in her presentation, saying that it's about responsibility and accountability and bringing the polity into the into a functioning democracy. Now, what courts do is they're very powerful. They can take money out of one pocket and put it into another pocket. A court can deprive somebody of their liberty. A court can deprive a parent of custody of their child. So when courts take actions like this and exercise enormous power, they ought to be accountable. So in my opinion, the reason for making court transactions available to the public is to make sure that the judges are honest, to make sure that the system is operating in a responsible way. I don't think, and this is my opinion, I don't think there's any public value in making the information about the child public. I don't think that there is value in making Social Security numbers public. I think the point is to make sure that the system is working appropriately. Ironically, I think what we have, in large measure, at least in my state, is we still have a lot of government in secret while information about litigants is disclosed. For example, the courts have budgets. They have to set priorities. We should know how they allocate resources for pretrial intervention, how much attention is being paid to drug court, whether mediation and arbitration will be encouraged vis-a-vis other more adversarial contexts for dispute resolution. In fact, we don't know so much about that because an awful lot of time and energy goes into disclosing information about the litigants. So I think we need to take a fresh look at our priorities. This goes to Helen Nissenbaum's analysis of privacy in context. But she also made the point that the medium is the message and that changing the medium of this information makes a substantial difference. Steve Schultz, would you be willing to talk for a moment about the public interest in making sure that records go online?
Sure, yeah. And I think it's a fairly simple case. I think the interest in making them available online and the interest in making them available in electronic format free of charge more generally is so that we can do precisely the things that Grayson was just discussing better. The primary reason from my perspective to do so is that it helps enhance transparency, accountability, equality, establishment of and enforcement of precedent. We had an excuse not to make them available electronically and online when there weren't good technologies for doing so. The courts have historically essentially done the best they can with technologies at hand. When proceedings weren't being recorded at all and there was no good means for widely distributing print materials, the best approach was to allow anyone to come into the courthouse. When they were being recorded in print form and stored at the courthouse, the best that they could do is allow people to come and inspect the records. Well, we're far from the best that we can do in the digital era. So I think part of the problem is that our public access policies aren't keeping up with technology. And there are a variety of examples of very specific public benefiting activities that could be done if the materials were available for free and electronically online. For example, I know quite a few different academics that look at different portions of the judiciary to try to understand trends over time or judge bias or those sorts of things. And in order to do those types of analyses, they require a full text electronic corpus. I was just having an email exchange with a law professor who has done a lot of empirical research in the past, and he mentioned that before the records were electronic, some of his colleagues, in order to get all the documents they needed, essentially hired teams of law students, bought their own photocopy machine, and flew them around to different courts in order to make copies in the basements of the courtrooms. Well, that was perhaps appropriate for the time, but the reality is that we can have a much larger set of people participating in democracy-enhancing aspects of accessing these court records as the cost of distributing documents electronically gets closer and closer to zero. I'll say on the sensitive materials and the question of is there ever an interest in publishing things like names of minor children and divorce proceedings, I think there rarely, of course, there rarely, if ever, is. But we already, at least at the federal level, and I know that for many or most states, have rules saying that those pieces of information are not to be put in the public record, and counsel has been sanctioned for doing so in some cases. So I don't think it's a matter of choosing whether or not we publish names of minor children or we put things available online. We need better practices around essentially scrubbing these documents before they go public. But it would be a shame and it would be bad overall for democracy if we let those concerns completely stand in the way of making these kinds of documents available to the general public.
Can I jump in, or do we have questions?
Yes, you have a question from the line of James of Dayton.
James, go ahead.
Well, actually, my question, and Steve has answered a lot of the question so far, but it was going to start out to be my understanding on the primary reason things are made available is, in fact, precedent. Our whole judicial system focuses on precedent. And part of precedent is letting the future attorneys and litigants know what's happened in the past,
mm-hmm.
how the courts have determined things, and even in things like domestic cases, you know, there is some merit to knowing the facts that a judge has said warrant, you know, a certain decision or deciding a certain way. Now, there's certainly a good deal of facts that would be confidential. I mean, visitation rights and visitation schedules and things like that. But don't you think that is best addressed perhaps by the judicial college sort of developing rules and educating judges as to what may and may not be included in their opinions?
This is Lily. That is exactly the point of having fair information practices policies or principles for the type of data that is being collected. that you have uniform procedures, that there are established practices that give guidance for how, when, where, and what type of information should be included in records, so that across courts, within, and even courts within the same jurisdiction, the process would be uniform. The promoting of democratic values for access and transparency, those are all very important. But when you get to the granular discussion of what types of personal identifiable information, not getting into discussions about sensitive, but just the basic principles of personal identifiable information that would be made available to the public and for what purpose, that is where it's very important for there to be established why this is important to share, what benefit is it providing to the community. And in the case of courts, rarely are both parties in a court because they choose to be there. Often their data is collected, retained, and shared based on a prosecution or a conflict or some matter being brought before the court to be settled. So the control over the data that's being collected is severed, which is typically what exists outside of court cases in the private sector, so that the relationship between the individual and the data being collected is a lot more firmly defined. But in the court environment, that relationship between the data subject and the data being collected, that right is not clearly defined. So establishing rules regarding that would be a more sure way to establish democratic, or at least address fairness issues regarding what data is collected, and at least forethought in the importance of data being shared to reach the objectives that are important when it comes down to transparency, accuracy, reliability, but also the privacy interests of those involved in court proceedings.
This is Steve. I'll chime in with a very brief comment on that. I think the question of the connection between the control of the individual and the record is a critical one, and I do think that the way that our federal rules are set up right now, where it's essentially incumbent upon counsel to do the redaction, and the courts assume that that the adversarial process will take care of it, makes the assumption that the person whose data might be disclosed has representation there in that process. And sometimes that's the case because the private data relates to parties in the case, but sometimes it's a third party. And we've seen examples of these disclosures where, you know, dozens of people's medical records who are perhaps even unaware that the case is going on, probably unaware, have their data disclosed, and there's really no one there representing their interests. That's where I think that at least the federal approach to this problem falls apart a bit, and perhaps, as the caller suggests, more emphasis on an active role by the judiciary itself would be appropriate.
Am I still on?
Yes.
Okay. Could I chime in again? Because I think that makes a good point. But sometimes if a party brings a suit against their employer for saying you've discriminated against me for disability, there will be medical facts in the record that very much play into the decision that was made. And I think, and this is another reason I think the judicial is the place to deal with that, because they're the ones that are sitting there, the judges are, and can make that decision. Does this have something to do with the case or doesn't it? And my next question would be, if it's controlled at that level, then when it comes out, when the opinion is issued, then wouldn't it be a slippery slope to have people correcting or changing the opinion that the court has issued? I mean, it seems to me it's not up to me as an attorney to say, well, they didn't mean to put this medical information in there, or they didn't mean to do this. I mean, the judge should have known what to and not to put in his opinion, and for me to second guess that.
But this I think there are two issues.
Okay.
One is the findings of the records of the court need to be complete and accurate. The second issue is a third party having access to that information. That is the question that has to be dealt with regarding what is appropriate to share and what isn't.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
Yeah, and I think that's where the judges would come in. I think you're right. There are two different questions here.
But what about the issue of employee of consent? For example, if there's a case involving the ADA, what about the consent of someone who may not be a may not even be the plaintiff? Do people aren't there situations where people don't even realize that their records are being attached as exhibits to summary judgment motions?
I would add that, this is Lily with EPIC, I would add that it has a chilling effect on the willingness of some people who feel they have been wronged to come to a court to seek redress of a grievance because of the knowledge that that information may be shared in as a part of court records. I think it's appropriate for this discussion about the rules being laid out that part of the evaluation of what should and shouldn't be shared should be the impact on the community, the chilling effect it would have on those who should come to the court for redress of grievances, and the question of whether it's pertinent or necessary to disclose certain facts to the general public.
Okay, well, I mean, that's a good preliminary answer. There's just quite a few differences in various cases. Again, you know, chilling effect might be one thing, but if somebody's bringing into court, then they know it's going to be public. So you have to balance those two things out, the interest of the public and of course, the fact that you don't want it to be have a chilling effect. So.
Yeah, but you do want people to get redress of wrongs. And,
right. Yes.
You know, for their private medical information to be available is not, it could have a chilling effect. And I would also point out that there's been a recent appeal to administrative decision by the EEOC that the specifically rules that when employers are providing medical records pursuant to a subpoena, that they need to get the employee's written consent. And by getting that written consent, employees at least have the realization that their records may be made public, and whatever that's worth. But I think we are...
go ahead.
I think we're at the point now where we have to end our... I don't know if we can
Excuse
go on, because it's 1:30.
Excuse me, we have a question from Allison of Atlanta.
Good. Hello. I didn't know whether I had properly done what I needed to do. I'm overseeing open records for a state agency, and was very interested in the tools you had described that would kind of automatically scan for Social Security numbers, et cetera, and one of the things we have to do in order to comply with open records law is identify the records, figure out what portions of the records should not be disclosed, and then redact them and get them out the door in a ridiculously short amount of time. And I was wondering if anyone is familiar or can recommend systems or best practices for gathering large quantities of data electronically and having a computer kind of help with this process of flagging information and redacting it.
Well, this is Lily with EPIC. There are a couple of issues with what jurisdictions are trying to do. There are paper records that jurisdictions are scanning to try to digitize those records. You can conduct a process called OCR, which is basically making digitally scanned data searchable. Mm-hmm. And then there's another process where you have digital records that are put in. It's a database where you have header fields, first name, last name, Social Security number, et cetera, where you can tag the header field. It's called extendable markup language. It doesn't matter what the data is, but you can create these tags for the fields.
I'm sorry, what do you mean by...
It's extensible markup language. It's like the field for first name.
Uh-huh.
Inside a computer, it's like a bucket, okay, this is the first name bucket, this is a middle initial, this is the last name bucket.
Right.
You can do a search saying, I'm looking for all the Pauls. And so it'll pull, go to that first name bucket and pull up all the names, that first name Paul spelled the way that you're seeking, or some indication of the letters that you put in, and pull up all those names and then the associate data with that. If you use extensible markup language, you can go to the header field for first name and give it a tag that name for first name and last name, et cetera. You can then go and say certain fields should not retrieve that data when you're pulling the records that may be shared or made available for the purpose of transparency of court process. And that way you don't worry. As long as the fields have the correct information in them, you can only pull the data that you intend to share. But this gets to, although you might have a perfect digital process, if the data entry person inputs the wrong information in a field, then you can have a problem where data is disclosed, not because the system didn't pull only the data you wanted, but because of the data entry errors that have occurred. But each of those, if you investigate them and find out which one is appropriate, you still need to verify that you're effectively going to get what you intend to get from the change.
Well, is there any record management system or anything that because for open records, certainly having standard practices say that, for example, the identifiable information of the Social Security number is always placed in the upper right-hand corner in this spot, or some kind of best practices or procedures for how you create information in the first place, so that because it's all public, so that when we have an open records request and it's retrieved, that identifiable information can be easily redacted. Do you know of any best practices or policies or?
Right, there's.
I'm sorry. I hate to interrupt.
Oh, sorry, we're out of time.
Right in the middle of it.
Okay.
But we have to end the call now. And so, on behalf of the ABA, I'm Nicole Walthour, and I'm thanking all of you for joining us. I will now turn you over to the operator for some additional information. Operator.
On behalf of the American Bar Association, Section of Individual Rights and Responsibilities, Section of Environment, Energy, and Resources, Princeton University Center for Information Technology Policy, and the ABA Center for Continuing Legal Education, thank you for participating in this program. To learn more about the sponsors, visit the ABA website at www.abanet.org. Thank you and have a good day.